The rich have not been so powerful and mind-bogglingly wealthy since the Gilded Age of the late 19th century. Yet their grip on society has often been shrouded in a veil of adulation, enabled by a media that celebrates them rather than holding them to account. Economist Rob Larson discusses the multimillionaire and billionaire class, how they rule, and how to fight against them. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We live in a world of extreme inequality, in which the top echelons of society own the majority of our collective wealth. Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and six other rich men own as much wealth as 4 billion people, that is, half the world's population. To make sense of the power of the billionaire class, even more unfettered under Trump, we turn to economist Rob Larson, author of Mastering the Universe, The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do with Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. Here's my recent conversation with him, in which he discusses neoliberalism, a class offensive from above since the 1970s that has sought to slash public services and spending, empower free markets, and break unions. The wealthy have always had great influence over our political system, with obviously some ebbing and flowing, such as during the New Deal. Has something changed with the Trump presidency when we think about the billionaire class, the ultra, ultra wealthy? Is it that the covert is now just really overt? Or do you think there's a qualitative difference under Trump?
Yeah, that's a great question. Some of that, I think, will remain to be seen. You know, it's a real historical moment. For better or worse, mostly worse so far. So it's sort of unclear. I mean, a number of people are saying that this isn't neoliberalism anymore because of the outwardness and just the direct control by the very highest level of the ruling class, mostly like the mega billionaires that constitute Trump himself and most of his cabinet and his big advisors, Musk obviously being the most prominent one, the most powerful. I tend to feel this is still a continuation of neoliberalism. We're still seeing austerity. These guys are, Musk is laying off so far. Remains to be seen how it will stick, but large numbers of important public workers from major agencies, and we'll have more fraud. We're going to have a lot fewer public health care workers to help us with the next epidemic, whether that's bird flu or some other thing. Our public institutions will be slower. They'll be crappier. They won't work as well. That is still neoliberal austerity. Like, we're still subsidizing firms. Musk himself is, getting very large continuing contracts, as is Bezos. And obviously the whole military-industrial complex segment of the economy is riding high with all the contemporary wars and the desperate need to supply Ukraine and Israel with giant amounts of huge munitions. So I feel like it's just a more authoritarian turn in neoliberalism, but it is a turn, though. It is the case. Like, it's a major new stage, even if we still seem to be broadly in that same regime of just control by the ruling class, and doing these neoliberal measures of cutting away at our Medicaid or our Social Security or our public infrastructures in order to subsidize the wealthy and continue cutting their taxes, which of course will also happen in over the course of this year for sure.
Then to step back and understand sort of how we got to this moment, there has been a surge in recent years in the ranks of the billionaire class. Why is that? What got us to this point where the 1% has become so incredibly wealthy and powerful? Why so many billionaires?
Yeah, well, primarily that's a creature of two developments in the economy over the last 40 or so years, of this neoliberal period. One is just the result of those neoliberal policies, major reduction in the tax obligations across the board, but very primarily for those upper wealth echelon households, including like the unwes, the ultra high net worth individuals, as the financial industry calls them. It's people with a net worth of $30 million and up. That itself used to be a small category, and now there's far more billionaires today than there were ennuis in the 1980s when all of this began. So that reduction in their tax burden is a major part of it, but also it occurred at a time of significant economic growth through the development of what we now call high tech and the online economy, through the advent of the basic consumer PC industry in the 80s, all the way through the early internet in the 90s, and mobile computing in the 2000s, and now cloud and AI and every other thing in the 2020s. Like, that period of economic growth, along with the reduction in their tax burdens and the fact that so many of these figures own giant amounts of stock in firms that went through network effect driven semi-monopolization, like Microsoft's monopolization of global computing for 30 odd years, and Apple and Google having a duopoly over operating systems globally, and the social media network monopolies like YouTube and Meta's various platforms. Those things had stupendous growth at a time that these guys' wealth was decreased. And so those two things together are usually credited with driving the real explosion of billionaires and kind of putting that concentration of wealth closer and closer back to what we estimate were the levels that we had in the original era of American capitalism, that late 1800s Gilded Age era of Rockefeller and Carnegie. Every tax cut and every year of growth puts more trillions of dollars in this class's pockets. So sooner or later, we'll be back to the very origin of capitalism levels.
How should we wrap our minds around the extent of wealth that the 1% has? Numbers can be just daunting. It's sort of hard to think about them in terms of the larger economy. How do you illuminate the mass accumulation of wealth at the top?
That's a really good question. I discuss this with a lot of people because it's a really major problem. It's difficult because numeracy is a whole skill besides literacy, and conceiving of orders of magnitude and the scale of things in the universe is like a difficult skill that takes its own work to master, just like literacy does. So one thing I always just tell my students or people talking about this, since we're talking now about people with wealth in the billions, for our richer families and individuals, and obviously well above just a billion, but just to take that versus $1 million. Because, a middle-class person in the United States at the end of their career may have saved $1 million or two, like many baby boomers and Gen Xers who have professional-class jobs and timed their home purchases well by skill or by chance, and, had a family in good health through most of their lives. They may end up at the end of their career with $1 or $2 million. Like, that's common. So if you wanted to just count, this is what I always say, if you want to count to 1 million, counting like a number per second, it takes about 11 days of continuous counting. It's a long time. If you want to count to 1 billion, that takes about 103 years.
A big difference.
A significant distinction there. Yeah, exactly. I feel like that is something that at least puts, it helps people realize the feeling of this. When people start to think of those numbers, you get the feeling that you get when you look off a great height or the top of a building and you kind of go, ooh, you get that sinking feeling in your stomach. Like, that is the appropriate response to thinking of the magnitudes of money involved here. And just the difference that makes in lifestyles. And of course, I talk about this a lot in the recent book. It's not merely a huge level of security, although even that is something that we middle and working class people can barely imagine. Like, these people, you own your home outright. You own it. It's yours. And you probably own a number of additional homes, very nice homes potentially, or fancy apartments in cities, and you can go between them when you feel like it. That's nice. But beyond just that security, like, the amount of help that that buys, you have household help that covers for you all the time and does all of your tasks and will get on your private plane to fly back to New York for a bottle of champagne that you really want while you're partying in Miami that night. Like, it's an amazing lifestyle distinction, but it can only happen because of the just bottomless ocean of money that is in the possession of some of these, as we said, high-end ruling class figures. So little things like that, I think, can help people conceive the numeracy of it and just the night and day lifestyle difference as well.
You mentioned earlier the tech billionaires and the companies that have made them so rich. And in Mastering the Universe, you argue that Silicon Valley joins Wall Street as the central sector of modern capitalism. And unlike some sectors of the U.S. economy, Silicon Valley has launched legions of billionaires through collecting our data, by shaping the information that we have access to. In other words, they have enormous political power, in addition to the power that somebody who is super rich also has. Do you think we should be especially concerned about them?
Oh, naturally. I think Americans are inherently very, you know, wary of that kind of thing. But it's true, you know, and it's funny because, you know, we look at the tech industry specifically, and of course I wrote a whole book separately on those jerks, Bit Tyrants, on Silicon Valley. You know, it's a fascinating thing because many of these people, like many CEOs, like, they're socially liberal. You know, they, you know, support racial integration and have gay friends and, you know, frequently vote for Democrats and so on. But economically, you know, they're still conservative tyrants by their nature. And so in Trump's first term, one of his first acts was to have all of the tech CEOs come meet with them at Trump Tower in 2017. I remember this and discussed that big event in the book, and people were kind of, wow, you know, these great liberal business people are talking to this arch conservative. I don't, you know, how's that going to go? And this time they just openly stood behind him physically, like they literally physically stood behind him at the inauguration. And now everyone's like, oh yeah, you know. Meanwhile, these are the same firms that in 2020 were just falling all over each other to talk about how concerned they were about over-policing in black communities. I mean, these are corporate entities and they're billionaire stock equity owners. Like, they don't really have principles beyond the aggrandization of themselves and their wealth and the estimated value of their equity portfolios, you know. So when they enter into policymaking, I mean, that's been just the entire history of capitalism, has been these figures who have, you know, if you have so much wealth, just think about what you can do with that. You can threaten to lay off all your workers and any governor will be listening to you. And you can use your money to buy newspapers, build a media empire. These guys love that, from Rupert Murdoch to Elon Musk. Like, these characters' first instinct is to buy one of the major vehicles for discourse and control it and block nominations if you're worried about them, or down throttle people who don't pay you a dollar for a special check mark or something. Like, they have many levers of power, indeed. So then when they further have influence over policy production, it's just like wall-to-wall control over society, not to overdraw the point. There's always resistance and opposition, especially through labor, of course. But absolutely, like, their control, when you look at it globally like that, is pretty daunting. Like, it is extensive. And to have figures like Musk just standing in the Oval Office over the president and talking about all his vague suspicions for waste and how we're going to cut things out. It's unusual for it to be that naked, you know. Even, you know, the George W. Bush administration or the Reagan administration, they'd hire people straight out of Wall Street, oil industry, media to regulate themselves all the time. But they would sort of say, well, now I'm the Secretary of the Treasury or of whatever. And so we're doing this through a public interest thing, rather than just standing there in their weird billionaire outfit and saying, yeah, I don't know, I'm sure that some of you people should be at work, so I'm just going to cut the funding for this myself. It is, fundamentally, it is still a continuation of the U.S. history, even if it's far more naked and has more of a looting character right now. Again, it's an emerging moment, so we'll see how far this goes. It's a very thin congressional majority, which will end up mattering once Trump has shot his executive order ammunition. So time will tell.
Well, let's talk about Elon Musk, who, you know, seems to be playing a singularly powerful role in the government right now, even though he just happens to be the richest man in the world. How is he benefiting, both kind of immediately and more broadly, from essentially being put at the helm of the federal government to slash it away?
Sure. Well, I mean, here, one reason people are so annoyed about this is how brazen this is. So he's not even really concealing or, allowing that there could be anything wrong with his practices of actively pressuring, like, other civil servants from his own position in the government in ways that directly benefit his ongoing private sector interests. Remember, most people, when they enter into government service, there's disclosure requirements. If you're a cabinet officer, you often have to put your assets in a trust or sell them at a discounted tax rate. Musk has a designation as a special government employee. So he has a window of time before he'd have to do these things and therefore, doesn't have to do them while he goes about his damage. Definitely benefiting directly from a number of these things. The FAA, for example, the airways regulator in the U.S. Have dinged SpaceX, Musk's alleged space exploration company, a number of times for incredibly destructive and polluting practices that SpaceX carries on. And these fines are many millions of dollars, like a microscopic amount, certainly to Musk personally, and even to the budget of SpaceX. And he's been saying for years that the FAA is out to get me and is stifling innovation, all the usual right-wing canard about how these entities that we have, of course, because we used to have unregulated sectors, and then disasters happened, so we created the FAA, a series of early large airplane accidents in the United States. People realized we need a regulator. We need a system of having standardization and air traffic controllers in some uniform manner so people can fly around. Musk and other industrialists are very annoyed by this kind of regulation because it puts any impingement on their near-term profitability and just on their magic authority and grandeur in general. So on the morning of that horrible DC airport helicopter airline crash, Musk leaned on the head of the FAA to quit, and they did that morning. Like, when that crash happened, we had no head of the FAA. We had an acting figure because the leading person quit that morning because Musk was now, standing right next to the president at events and saying, yeah, you should quit. And the person's like, all right, I'm not gonna sit here and live through this, So like, that's one example. NASA is about to give SpaceX another large contract. From news recently, supposedly actual Cybertrucks are gonna get purchased by the State Department to be armored up for diplomatic personnel. This is something people are referring to. I'll believe it when I see it. But the point is, I mean, right there, we have a large number of examples. And of course, Musk's people have been in the nerves of the Treasury system now. And while federal court rulings have told them they have to be now restricted to read-only access and have to destroy any information they took out of it, who knows if they are or did? Who knows what was done? Musk now has Trump publicly occasionally questioning whether we'll pay all of the U.S. like government bonds that we issue. People have no idea what that is tampering with. So the potential for a huge disaster because of Musk's hasty, reckless, idiotic self-dealing is pretty high, I would say. And of course, this is just a small part of what's been going on.
I'm speaking with economist Rob Larson. He's the author of Mastering the Universe: The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do with Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So is what you've just been talking about maybe the most overt version of it, but is political power the point of being ultra wealthy? There's probably a limit to the satisfaction that a multimillionaire or billionaire gets from getting yet another mansion or yet another yacht. But is power, political power, the ultimate luxury acquisition?
It's an interesting question because it absolutely is, especially in like legislatures and parliaments, like approaching a commodity with a going price. So like there is a case to be made for that. It really seems to depend on the exact egomaniacal rich person we're discussing. Some of them clearly aspire to, I should be the person who's most talked about, which is definitely how Trump has seen this whole quest in his administration. It's not because he had these grand legislative designs other than immigrants are gross, get rid of them, because he wants to be at the center of attention. And, boy, has that been successful. For many billionaires and just wealthy, families and so on, like there's not much aspiration to political participation beyond, of course, pouring resources into the right senators and the right representatives and so on, because of the attention that it brings. Like, it is a fact, when you're in politics or just a major donor, you begin to get drawn into the public eye. And we should remember, when we talk about these guys, that, you know, we naturally tend to think of the big on TV brand name billionaires, Trump and Bezos and Gates and Zuckerberg and Musk and so on, which is natural. And they're often some of the most powerful ones, so that's fine. But we should remember, too, there's a large, large number of billionaires in the United States that none of us have heard of or none of us know by name, because it's some obscure hedge fund manager in, you know, New York who lives in a large house in Connecticut, or, you know, some venture capitalist investor who lives in Central California estate someplace. And they're not prominent, so we don't know them. There's a lot of power and wealth and satisfaction from that that exists. I wouldn't want us to feel that to take over the political reins also is the goal of individual rich capitalists. Obviously, many of them aspire to that. And as a class, through their corporate property and through their own wealth, I think the effect is to control the state in most of its arms, as I've been suggesting. But at the same time, so many of these people just want to quietly live their unbelievably affluent elite lives. And as you said, I mean, it's, I have that thought sometimes too, like, great, another mansion. Like, how many do you need? Yeah, but you know, you have to see the world as they see. You can go anywhere in the world if you're in this echelon of wealth. You can go wherever you want. You don't go to the airport and wait in a grubby line. You get on a plane that your family owns or that you have a share agreement with of some type. And you fly privately and you go to some other beautiful place and you can travel with the seasons. You can go anywhere you want. You can make your home what you would like it to be. The amount of privilege that does come with this kind of wealth, I just wouldn't discount that. Plenty of these megalomaniacal freaks are dying to also be senators or have other forms of outright political power. I mean, we're seeing that now with this cabinet, after all, you know, the Treasury and Commerce and Energy and Interior secretaries, you know, all mega billionaires. So it's clearly a species of rich guy that also wants to be, you know, super rich and powerful, you know, politically powerful. At the same time, you know, Rupert Murdoch's never held office. And I'd say he's one of the most powerful men in the world because he owns Fox and the Wall Street Journal. And by God, those have reshaped the entirety of the Anglosphere political landscape. A lot of power in the private sector itself.
Right. And then, and presumably for maybe a savvy person like Murdoch, there's also the awareness that, although certainly he has not been shy about trying to influence the powerful, at the same time not being an elected figure, not putting yourself out there the way that, although unelected, Musk is right now, means that on some level there is maybe an awareness that there could be a backlash if you are too overt with your power. Do you think that that is a consideration? I mean, if you think about the way that the billionaire class has often operated behind AstroTurf organizations and, you know, industry front groups, so that you're not necessarily connecting the person to the effort. And in fact, often the kinds of efforts that they fund are there to deflect away from their actual concentrated power and to present the issues that benefit them or the policies that would benefit them as somehow in the public good or being driven by citizens groups.
Absolutely. I mean, well, certainly I think that there is, but as far as their view, I mean, I think it's exactly what you referred to there. If these figures did not fear a backlash and like real opposition to their actions, they wouldn't be taking the actions that they take, such as putting large amounts of money into exactly think tanks, the large number of entities like the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Manhattan Institute and the Hoover Foundation. There's an endless, endless number of these awful little pseudo-academic departments. Their takeover of academia on the right has only been somewhat successful, so they also just fund this whole parallel network of it. Why would they do that if not to put ideas that they consider to be more favorable to their interests into the minds of more students and, you know, media consumers? Like, the fact that they do that shows that they're aware that this can all be, like, contested at least. There's a reason why firms go to the wall to break unions and spend large amounts of money on fancy scumbag consultants and attorneys to help them fight union drives. It's because unions are historically effective at uniting the workforce and overcoming racial and gender divides in bargaining units frequently, and getting better pay and benefits and vacation time for their members. So you go really hard against those. Similarly, they go hard to maintain control over the state, which is the only institution that exists that could theoretically legally sanction having their property expropriated. But it is, it's a republic. In the developed world, we have some form of democracy. And so you need the public to broadly believe it. And there is that, but I would also add again, too, the vanity of some of these guys is beyond belief. So I do think part of this is just, that's right, CTS. Here's a large grant, Institute for Right-Wing Canard. I'd like you to tell everyone about how great I am. Make sure everyone's thinking about my wonderfulness all the time. That is also in the mix for many of these guys. But I agree, bottom line, this is about helping tamp down an opposition, give smarter, ambitious people a smart-sounding excuse for being rich, and encourage them, of course, the American style, to believe that they're just about to be rich themselves any minute now, which is the American dream. Those things together, I think, and they have been effective.
Well, let me ask you more about that. Because on the one hand, there's a lot of hatred out there for the rich, and certainly a long history in the United States of suspicion and overt conflict from the bottom up against the rich. But then there's also a current of people, working class people, but not just working class people, that we could have a whole other conversation about small business owners who, are actually another key pillar of support for the right and including Trump. But, you have many people who feel awed by wealth and identify with wealth. And perhaps this will shift as Trump's second administration unfolds, who knows? But how important do you think is that current in American politics?
Yeah, it's pretty significant. I mean, and you are quite right. If you look at US history, it was founded legally by the attorneys of the wealth of the country at that time, founded socially by a bunch of crazy Puritans. But like the bulk of the early yeoman citizenry really sought like a agrarian republic and freedom from some local lord. But then came industrialization in the Gilded Age, and oh, what do you know? These railroad barons control us, and the steel and oil barons control them, and Wall Street controls those guys. It's like suddenly we're in a hierarchy of these, by today's standards, billionaire monopolists like Carnegie and Rockefeller and Morgan and Vanderbilt. So there's like a strong history of huge resentment against these figures for bringing to Americans, early white yeoman citizenry, the same kind of overlords that they re still remember their families fleeing from in the old world, in those days. So like that is like a major tendency there, and you get like part points where it breaks out significantly, like in the Sanders campaigns or in the William Jennings Bryan campaign 130 years before that. It does have its moments, but at the same time, the country is founded and designed to be such a have a government that has limited ability to regulate or impose taxes or other onerous conditions on the wealth. So it's always been something that has to deal with like enormous resistance because the state isn't set up to do that. And also, as you said, you have a large faction of the country at any time, and especially people, yeah, that we would call white collar or professional class, who are strongly encouraged, as everyone is, but more effectively sometimes in their case, to see themselves as aspirational, and you're climbing a ladder in society. We didn't make you a slightly better perch than the blue collar masses get because you have a valuable skill like bookkeeping or removing appendices. No, you're rising up. And there's a lot of appeal to their own vanity. And again, so many people are content if, even if they have a modest lot in life, as long as it's bigger than the poorest people. People have that aversion to being on the very bottom. And as long as they're not, like that has a big effect on people's contentment and self-image in hierarchical societies like we live in, you know? So it's true. Like there is always has been this tendency where people, yeah, identify with the wealth of society. And of course, the most likely to do that specifically are, as you just said, the petty bourgeois, as they used to say, the small business owners and, you know, small shopkeepers, and today, you know, small online business people who, you know, are very strongly encouraged to see themselves as colleagues of Warren Buffett and Mark Zuckerberg and Sheldon Adelson. Whereas in reality, of course, they struggle and their firms often make little money or survive based on cheap loans from the Small Business Administration for periods of time. Like, that's always been a strong tendency. And it's true, like, they do tend, therefore, to be a significant, even though, you know, their standard of living, I mean, of course, it varies, but it's usually not like what we consider to be a wealthy person. But because they have that identification, they'll vote highly conservative or more than that. And as you said, have been a big base of support for the current administration and were famous for their role in mid-century in Europe for being one of the portions of, for example, German society that was most friendly towards fascism because, you know, they saw the interwar settlement is disadvantaging Germany's economy and making it impossible for them to work. We need a strong Germany. So it's true, not a glorious political history there, but you can see the kind of economic manipulation, perhaps, that's leading to that.
Sure, and they were disproportionately represented in the January 6th rioters when there was a, you know, deep dive into people's backgrounds. That was a very well-represented group. I'm speaking with Rob Larson. He is the author of Mastering the Universe, The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do with Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. He's an economist. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. You mentioned earlier, Rob, the lifestyles of the wealthy, flying around the world, hopping from mansion to mansion. And I wanted to ask you about the environmental cost that is borne by the rest of us of having the wealthy live their lives the way that they do. You know, so much of the emphasis, much of the time, the analysis around consumption and its environmental costs is sort of class blind. But when you actually take the wealthy out of the picture and look at their contributions to fossil fuels and environmental destruction, their role is outsized. Tell us about how the wealthy are terrible for the planet.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's relatively easy to outline. And what you said is exactly right, and it's so annoying. The tendency is very reliably to, and now it's just so ingrained, people just do it, to treat environmental issues and sustainability as something that you do individually. And if you recycle a little more aluminum foil, like that is how we will affect major environmental change. Whereas, of course, you know, most of our environmental problems are systemic. They come out of our social and economic systems and are reflected by our consumption of habitat and our tendency to emit side products from making goods, such as microplastics and greenhouse gases and so on. So that's the first thing we need to recognize. But it is true that if we look at it in terms of rather than an individual lens, but also a class lens, we can also see quite a bit about exactly how all this environmental damage is being done. So here, I have a whole chapter in the book on the wealthy and the environment, and especially the climate. And it's interesting, some of the numbers I'm using here, I always like to plug the World Inequality Database. They do a huge amount of fantastic work, including country by country for most nations in the world for wealth concentration, but also for greenhouse gas emissions. Very, very valuable service there. And based on their research, they found that the wealthiest 1% of households, and this is worldwide, so globally, the richest one out of 100 households emits about 17% of all greenhouse gases. But I think more tellingly, the wealthiest 10% of households emit 47% of the total, almost half. Like an incredibly lopsided contribution to our environmental problems comes out of these super wealthy households that live these kind of, yes, as you said, carefree lives. A large part of their emissions comes from their giant travel footprint, especially those private planes with their stupendous costs and luxurious interiors also have enormously high per traveled mile per person emissions profile. which is pretty stunning to look at, especially because many of these figures enjoy flying these private planes to climate conferences incredibly offensively. And of course, the right just uses this and claims that climate change is something that rich people are forcing on you, poor working class person. These kinds of actions like help the right in those optics. But the other thing that really makes the wealthy responsible for a huge part of emissions, and especially emissions growth recently too, about 20% of our emission growth comes from that same top 1% globally. But the other thing that makes them share a very disproportionate responsibility is just to remember that it's these households that own the economy. They're the ones that own the stock and the equity in the giant companies and global firms of the world that do the industry. And industrial production is a gigantic source of all kinds of pollution, including greenhouse emissions. You know, it's not just your personal consumption of goods and your travel profile, you know, that reflects your individual or class-based carbon footprint. It's what you own. And remember, let's not forget, as I also discuss in the book, the richest 1% of Americans owns 40% of all stock. The richest 10% own 84% of it. So these figures, you know, they own the corporate world, and it's there that we see a huge amount of emissions themselves. About 54% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions come from industry versus 12% for residential emissions, you know, counting all classes together. So it's their ownership of the great polluting economy and their unbelievably licentious and pollution-heavy individual lifestyles that together make up the just stunning environmental burden of the world's ruling class. I mean, each of us Americans knows how wasteful we are. But if you look at these figures and their industrial empires, I would tell you it really puts your individual emissions in perspective. If you're feeling bad about your contribution, I invite you to take a look and learn about what some of these figures are doing, and it'll help you to put your blame for the problem in the right place.
You know that the conspicuous consumption, or even the private consumption, of the rich is nothing new, as was documented 125 years ago by Thorsten Veblen in his Theory of the Leisure Class. How have the lifestyles of the rich and famous changed since Veblen's time?
Yeah, it is interesting, and I talk about this in the book, and I honestly, I wrestle with it a little bit because it's not an incredibly clear picture. But of course, back in the old days, if you were one of the Gilded Age millionaires in those days, you're Rockefeller and so on. Like at that time, it was all about putting on very fancy attire, having the fanciest mansions in those days, New York City especially, and showing off in major ways. You know, importing whole estates from Europe and then rebuilding them in the United States, putting up castles like the Biltmore. Conspicuous consumption was very descriptive for that original era of the wealthy, going all the way through, of course, World War II, where through social democracy and taxes and wartime destruction of their wealth, the wealthy get put, I wouldn't say put in their place. People should remember, even during the height of the New Deal era in the U.S., you know, from the 30s to the 1980s, when we had those, by today's standards, very high taxes on wealthy households through progressive taxation, as we call it. Back then, the wealthiest, again, 10% of households, their share of the national income never goes under 33%. Like, even at the height of them being taxed and their corporate property being regulated, even then, they kept about a third of the national income. So they were never taxed to poverty, just to have that on the record. But since then, they've come back very strongly from all the tax cuts that we've had over succeeding Republican administrations. We're about to have another one next year, of course. And the rich are close to, we'll see what happens next year, they're close to being restored to their incredible position of wealth and influence they had during the Gilded Age. And if that happens, it'll just be a continuation of today. But what we're not seeing, yes, is a restoration of their old partying lifestyle. And these guys definitely do still show off and have parties, as has been discussed over a long period. Often that's more of a nouveau riche thing, where if you're a brand new, very wealthy person, you have more showing off to do, you're insecure, perhaps, so you do more flashy consumption, you know. But if you look at, like, the really wealthy persons of today,
As Kate Wagner, the great MASH in Hell originator, said in The Nation, and I quote her in the book, she makes the point that, like, the rich today are so rich, but they're so boring. Like, it's even more offensive that they're so wealthy. They don't even, like, look like a funny, weird dandy like they used to. If you look at, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos, I mean, they just look like normal soccer dads. They look like dudes, and they're wearing boring pullovers. And, of course, they're wearing very fancy, very expensive versions of normal-looking clothes. But it's still mostly, you know, collar shirts and sweaters and slacks or some jeans, maybe sneakers, maybe nicer shoes. Like, it could just be, like, today's wealthy, like, they could just be a successful dentist. The tendency is to affect a, if not blue-collar outward appearance, a white-collar one. So I'm just one of you employees, you know, I'm a cool boss. I'm not like a boss like I had who would fire people. So I dress normal, and here's my normal look. So these days, these guys definitely still party, but I think they keep it more private, is what we sort of arrive at. I mean, these guys have parties. They have NDAs at the beginning of the party. Like, that's a sign.
I'm speaking with economist Rob Larson. He's the author of Mastering the Universe, The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do with Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So now that we've talked about the wealth of the wealthy, the power of the wealthy, I wonder if you could help us understand how we should define the ruling class, because it's not simply about numbers, right? It's about their relationship to the society. In other words, why are the rich rich? What is their standing within the society as a whole?
Yeah, well, that's an incredibly important question. I appreciate that. And indeed, so, you know, what makes someone rich, or maybe more specifically, what makes someone, yeah, not just wealthy, but part of a ruling class somewhere? Usually ruling class, again, as we were saying before, sort of speaks to power within the society. And fundamentally, it is about that relationship. And as, you know, Marxists like to say, it's about your relationship to the economy and the economic institutions, specifically like the productive institutions. And so this is actually a really important point that I always try to hit on when I talk to people about this subject, because I think it's so important. So if we just go back again for a moment to those richest 1% of U.S. households by wealth that we were talking about before, we could take a look at what their ownership looks like financially, like in terms of stocks. And stocks and shares, of course, are just pieces of ownership of firms, right? If you buy a share of Microsoft, you own a tiny piece of that company and you're entitled to a tiny piece of its profits. We call that dividends, right? Well, stock ownership, so ownership of the corporate world. If you own all of a company's stock, you own the company. If you look at who owns that corporate stock, like, it's impressive. That top 1% of households by wealth owns, where do we have, right here, 40% of all stock. Similar to their share of overall national wealth. 40% of all stock, the richest 10% of households own 84% of all the corporate stock in the U.S. So that's most of it. You know, over 80% is most. So when companies report the large profits they've been reporting for the last 2 years, and which will surely grow as we move into this new administration, when firms report that, like, that profit doesn't just go to the company or its specific CEO, although, I mean, of course it does go to the CEO, but most of that corporate profit goes to these shareholders through dividends or through share buybacks, which have the same effect of raising the value of the stocks. Like, that's important. Like, that's the way that the wealthy own the companies that have been globalizing for 30 years, playing every working class against each other, US and Mexico being obvious cases, but of course there's plenty more. And that's important, right? Because it means for the rest of us, like, most households own no stock. You have no ownership in corporate America. Less than half of households have owned stocks since 2001. So that means most of us, you have one factor of production to sell, which is your labor, and you go and get a job. So you rent yourself to firms that are primarily owned by wealthy people. And that's the thing that makes it a ruling class. Like, they rule over us, the majority of regular schmucks who don't have a bunch of capital to live off the income from, which I would say is the real line that makes you rich, is, are you able to live comfortably off the income from your existing wealth, from your financial investments or whatever, whereas the rest of us, of course, are working for a living more unpleasantly. Like, that's important. And so their ownership of that stock and their ability to sustain their high standards of living from that, that's what makes it for a really rich household and for a member of the ruling class. Whether you're actively, you know, using your shareholder power to fire a CEO or direct corporate policy, you know, some rich people like that, some don't care, and they're happy to let the CEO run their companies that they own shares of. But either way, you're the one who owns that productive wealth. And of course, to, you know, more clearly answer the question, like the means of production, as we say, we just want to remember those are corporate property. You know, oil refineries that make our gasoline and propane for grilling, those things belong to ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, BP, and therefore they're rich shareholders. And the, you know, data centers that store your email and keep your YouTube video latency times low, like those things belong to Microsoft and Google and Amazon. And if you look at the other big productive property, like the big productive, you know, agricultural estates and the great construction and chemical firms and the railroads, like these huge, huge corporate networks that make all of our products, energy, chemicals, information technology, it's usually two or three large oligopoly corporations owned by the rich. So that's the nature of that relationship. Do you have to work for someone because they own the means of production and are therefore in a position to employ you? Or do you own the means of production and the schmucks work for you? Like, that is the fundamental class deciding question, certainly as socialists have always seen it.
Rob Larson, let me end with the hardest question. How do you think we should push back against the power of the billionaire class in this historic moment? Are you concerned at all about the danger of overestimating their power?
Absolutely. At least especially for this present administration, which people are, you know, so very concerned about, and reasonably so. Like this administration, it's already backing off from major stuff and having major first Trump administration screw-ups, like the early order suspending all grant processes and the Medicaid website coming down. They had to walk it back 2 days later. Classic early Trump, you know. And also, as I said, working with one of the thinnest congressional majorities in history, a majority that for many years now has had a large faction that refuses to pass basic government bills, especially budget bills, which means they have to make deals with the Democrats, who, for all their flaws, like, do lately have a history of forcing concessions. So this administration, I think, is a little weaker than it looks. Again, it's early days, so time will tell. However, the power of, like, these people historically, and the power of capitalists in world history, especially the U.S., is fairly incredible. And that, I mean, you know, again, as you said, we don't want to overestimate it. We should realize, like, they've turned away a lot of movements in the past. Like, it'll take a lot from us to be able to shift things. But there's stuff you can do. I mean, those simple reforms that would make a major difference in the daily lives of regular people, that a lot of the more left-wing political figures in the U.S. are supporting, like Medicare for All, as always, enduringly, remains the best one. It's so appealing. I mean, most people support it. Most Americans support it. A small majority of Republicans even support it. But it's, you know, hugely opposed by industry, of course. A lot of industries would be euthanized by that. And so they've been able to completely keep it off the political radar, except through the Bernie Sanders campaigns, of course, which, God bless them at least for achieving the goal, or at least the victory of putting these things into the public consciousness more, whereas before, you know, you had real ideological hegemony. It's tough. I mean, capitalists, they're powerful. You know, they control media, they control the state through various levels of directness and the productive economy, you know, but this is why the labor movement's like having at least a renaissance now, if not quite a resurgence yet. And like, that is what we can do, is like, stop feeling anxious by yourself. Go out and talk to your coworkers and try to get a beginning of moving toward a collective bargaining unit in your workplace, or get into a like political group that meets in your town. I guarantee you there are some. And I will tell you, like, the best thing when you're feeling anxious or fear about the world is to actually leave your home and workplace and go and talk to real IRL people and commiserate and make a plan to do something, even if it's just a demonstration. That is very useful for the world and can help. I mean, it's from those little seeds that the whole thing always grows. And we've seen lately in the world the ability of movements to stand up quite quickly with today's technology. For all of its drawbacks, it does seem to have enabled a certain amount of sparking power for in certain social moments. When you have a black swan event or some big surprising event, things can change quickly and become very fluid. So we should just be remembering that when we're thinking about the enduring power of these figures. I mean, regimes last a really long time, and then they fall over eventually and surprise everybody, as we saw just 2 months ago in Syria, for example. Obviously a smaller case, but we should bear in mind there are things you can do. And if you get out and work with your fellow human beings a little bit, like this, that is what hope there is. That's where it comes from.
Rebel Larson, thank you so much for coming back on the program.
My pleasure, Sasha. Always a good time.
Rebel Larson is professor of economics at Tacoma Community College. He is the author of Mastering the Universe, The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do with Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.